The Spectator combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, and get a £20 Amazon gift voucher absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/summer.
Hello and welcome to Marshall Matters with me, Winston Marshall, for The Spectator. Today I'm in Oslo and I have the privilege of speaking to North Korean defector, activist, author of the books In Order to Live, A North Korean Girl's Journey to Freedom and While Time Remains, Yeonmi Park. Yeonmi, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, I've just read your book and this astonishing journey, and I know you've spoken about it a lot, from North Korea through China, saved by Christian ministries, taken to Mongolia, then to South Korea, then to America.
Yeah.
And and now, I mean, from that astonishing start in North Korea, and you wrote about your father going to the Gulag and the very grim experience of your fellow North Koreans, and now in America, but also I find you in Oslo speaking at the Oslo Freedom Forum. And it's rather a change. I wondered how distant North Korea felt to you now, looking back at it.
Yeah, I think in a way, sometimes I hard like having time to like connect it. A lot of times it feels like I travel to a different universe, or at least like different planet.
Yeah.
And first several years, I had a hard time to adjust to it. Uh-huh. And now it's been quite some time, and I feel quite adjusted to the new environment, thankfully.
Oh, that's good. Does it seem somewhat miraculous to you, your journey?
Absolutely. It's unbelievable because there are 25 million North Koreans living in the country.
Yeah.
And a lot of them go to China, escape to China, and most of them trapped there.
Yeah.
They cannot get out of China.
Uh-huh.
And only about like 209 of us made it to America.
209?
Yeah, over the last 8 years.
Wow.
So statistically, I don't know how lucky you have to be among the 25 million to go to America and even come to Oslo.
Do you feel a sort of responsibility then? Your life now, talking about North Korea, is that, do you feel a duty to talk about what's happening there?
Yeah, I think in a way, the life that was given to me, especially after crossing that desert into Mongolia to be free, I was always thinking about there got to be a reason why I got saved.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really have this sense of, you know, purpose in my story.
Yeah.
And it gives me also a lot of hope.
Yeah.
You know, what's possible? Like, my story cannot be possible in any way, logical sense.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm hopeful for what can be possible for North Korean people who are remaining there.
Does that trip across the desert, of all the things, is that the thing that was the hardest? Is that, when you mention it there, is that because that was the kind of nadir of the escape?
Yeah, I think nothing ever taught me more than that night, being on the desert.
Yeah.
It, in a way, you know, even though the world just abandoned me, I was on the world alone.
Mm.
I was completely invisible from everybody else.
Mm.
And I think fighting for life, fighting for dignity, that's, it taught me so much about even gratitude, like that somebody knows me, you know, that somebody sees me. So, yeah.
when you say somebody, who do you mean by that?
Because in China, I had to be invisible.
Uh-huh.
I had to, even breathing was like painful. Like people could not find me. If I were caught, they would send me back to North Korea.
Uh-huh.
It's like, in a way, the Anne Frank hiding in the house.
Yeah.
Every little move is a danger, right?
Wow.
And then from there to going to Mongolia in the middle of the desert, it felt like everybody abandoned me. You know, I was just alone fighting for my life. And now I'm here, people know my name.
Yeah.
I don't have to hide who I am.
Mm.
I don't need to look going on the street, seeing police, I don't have to run away.
Yeah.
And even saying my name was a danger in China. I could not say any word. We had to pretend a lot of times. We were a, what is the thing that you don't know how to speak? Or
you didn't understand, you're a foreigner. That, or
so a lot of North Koreans try to survive by acting crazy. So if they're in the bus, people ask who you are, then you cannot say who you are.
Yeah.
So they act like they are like mentally ill, literally. Or sometimes they cannot say anything worse. Or they, like, you know, or like deaf.
Uh-huh.
We pretend those things to survive.
But they would recognize that you were Korean and not Chinese, right?
Because our Chinese are not good.
Your Chinese is not good, but also you're different people. That's you would look different in China. Is that, or is there a Korean? Is there a Korean in population in that part of China?
You can, I think, you pull that off. Look, if you wear some of Chinese clothes, but once you say a word, that's when you give all the clues.
Okay.
So you cannot say anything.
I'd like to understand North Korea a bit, because it seems to me, even after reading your book, it's not just another place. It seems like another time.
Yeah, and for sure.
And I guess there's one particular story in your book that stood out, and it was when, well, there was many, but one of them, which was when Kim Jong-il died, and there was a mandatory mourning period. And I wanted to understand whether, and so people were sort of forced to grieve,
right,
or told to grieve.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether there were people in North Korea, even amongst this sort of dire living conditions, who actually were grieving, who actually are sort of patriotic to the dynasty in power there. And is North Korea full of people who actually hate it but can't say anything? Is everyone keeping quiet and not saying what they think? What's the dynamic? Is there a portion of each, or is it one swing one way?
I think so. That's the thing. When I was there, I saw two deaths of Kim Il-sung when I was really baby, and then second was Kim Jong-il's death when I was like almost grown person.
Yeah.
When the dictators dies, people do get shocked. Uh-huh. They think they are gods. Yeah. And even my mother was so, she's like a university educated woman.
Yeah.
Studied like, you know, chemistry, science, and she thought how does possibly God can die? And she thought that was the end of the world orbit. That's how the end of the universe began for her.
So she was very sad about it.
And and like in this period of day, you say like even sometimes 3 years of mourning or 3 months of mourning and that year mourning, they put that phase, and if somebody laugh, and that's how you sent to concentration camp.
Wow.
It's just you cannot laugh entire that month and month period. And people do get sad genuinely. Yeah. It's a
Do you think your mother was sad genuinely?
Absolutely. She mourned so much. Yeah. And actually Kim Jong-il died after I escaped to South Korea.
Yeah.
And I was shocked. Even though I was in living in freedom, I couldn't believe actually he died.
Was there any sadness to it, or was there a sort of was shock but happy that, or was, what shock was accompanied by what emotion?
So in a way I believed that he was immortal, like I didn't think that he would die. And then first he was dying was like shock, and second was, you know, my happiest dream of North Korea when I was living there was in my dream I was meeting him. He came to my town, I was meeting my dear leader. And that dream comforted me through a lot of hard times in my life, being in North Korea. So in a way, for me, at school, literally, my school teacher teaches, since we are tiny little like child, they say the most important thing in your life is not your actual father. The biological father is not important to you. The most important person in your life is our dear leader. So he was the most important person in my whole life.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the saddening was there.
Yeah.
But by then in South Korea, I understood that he was a dictator.
Yeah.
But in a way, the mind, like your brain and heart moves differently.
Uh-huh.
So whenever I see the picture of Kim Il-sung with like his beautiful portrait, and around it, like North Korean children and flowers, like my heart just like feels warm and respect.
Wow.
And then my brain kicks in like several seconds later, that's a fake portrait.
Yeah.
It's a dictator brainwashing us.
So that's such an interesting difference, because you're obviously such an outspoken critic of North Korea, perhaps the world's leading critic of North Korea, and yet you had that inner sense of patriotism. And so do you think that the North Koreans, if that's generally held, is that what keeps the kind of communist totalitarianism together, that sort of deep patriotism? Is that what's keeping it somehow glued together?
I think several things connecting it. Like one is really absolute fear and zero tolerance. You know, there's a Netflix series, I think, the Dictator's Handbook, and talking about different dictators and how North Korea is able to maintain it. That is where you get zero tolerance, complete brutality. You do not compromise in any single way. Mm-hmm. You just go for it, kill them all. Mm-hmm. 3 generations, 8 generations, get rid of every possible seed that can resist the ideology. That is number one in North Korea. Like literally recently, North Korean regime sentenced 2-year-old to concentration camp. What 2-year-old can possibly do to deserve that?
On what grounds?
Because the parents of this child had owned the Bible. And North Korea is the number one nation that persecutes Christians. Yeah. So they would send a literally 2-year-old to concentration camp. And of course, the 3 generations of that parents gone together. And I think this keeps North Korea in a way intact. Because everybody knows they cannot rebel.
It's old-fashioned Stalinism then.
Yeah. But like a lot of countries, usually they lose that grip. They become softened. Even Libya, like if you see other dictatorships, they become softer eventually. But North Korea was able to dire the fear every single time, bringing the more medieval time, dark age method. And they are willing to do that.
You've mentioned the Christian and the Bible being there, but you also talk about Kim Jong-un as a God figure.
Yeah.
What role does religion have in North Korea? Is there a religion that, or a metaphysic underneath Kim Jong-un?
Right, so North Korea is the regime is a religion, right? They copy the religion. So what's interesting about why they fear Christianity so much is that Kim Il-sung was raised in a Christian family. And Pyongyang used to be a very thriving Christian time where there were a lot of missionaries came from the West. And then Kim Il-sung, when he became a dictator, he copied the Bible. He copied the Ten Commandments. And he said, I loved you so much, I'm giving you my son, Kim Jong-il. His body dies, but his spirit is with us all the time. That's how he knows our thoughts, what we think, and that's how people are even afraid to think. And because he copied the Bible, if people read the actual Bible that was written many thousands of years before him, we're going to know that he's the fake. That's why he fears the Christianity so much more. But there are no existence of any religion. They officially say they allow like freedom of religion, but in reality, nobody can. We don't even know what religion means. We don't even have the word God. They deleted that word in our dictionary, so people don't even understand the concept of believing in God.
Wow. So how did the Bible that you described earlier get into it? Are there Christians quietly working preaching or reading scripture in secret, in underground? Is there a Christian movement?
So there's no movement whatsoever in North Korea. There are 120,000 concentration camps. Like, so North Korea has different prison camps. Labor camp, where my father went. And then re-education camp is where more like 1 to 5 year prison. And then concentration camp. In concentration camp, you go with your entire generation of family, go there. And you cannot come out. That's a death sentence. Usually you don't last even 3 months once you stand there. You die within 3 months. In this concentration camp, there are like more than 120,000 people right now inside, and 70,000 of them are Christians. So every single one of them have a faith, go to prison and die there. But these Bibles go through China. So a lot of South Korean missionaries go to China and then find the smugglers and smuggle Bibles inside North Korea. And then people who get the book, they get executed and sent to prison camps.
So the books are coming in without preachers, the books are coming in alone. So if there's not, you know, you receive a book like this and there's not someone to tell you what the book is, how do North Koreans interpret? Or is it part of a lot of books that are coming in?
Yeah, so this is a thing where when North Koreans escape to China, the missionaries keep us safe in their, like, something called safe houses underground. And we get trained to become Christians. And then the ones get really, truly converted, the ones who are willing to die for God's glory, they ask them sometimes, do you want to go back to North Korea, give your life to God, and preach the Bible to other people? So some people go back to North Korea to die for the gospel.
And those are the Christian martyrs then?
Yes, they are the ones. And yeah. Thankfully, those Christians didn't ask us to do that. So we were able to go freedom. But sometimes they do ask, like, do you want to go back to North Korea and preach the gospel and then willing to die for God's glory? And some people do.
Does any part of you want to go back to North Korea?
when it's free, I mean, yeah, absolutely not. If I go back, I'm going to get executed, yeah, right there. Yeah.
Okay. So I just read recently that according to South Korean intelligence, mm-hmm, so it's, we can't be sure for certain, the suicide rate is increasing in North Korea, yeah, and they're saying a rate of 40%, and that to combat that, Kim Jong-un is holding local authorities, mm-hmm, accountable if the suicide rate goes up, they're to be punished,
yeah,
for that. If the situation is so bleak and people are so desperate that they're killing themselves at such an increasing, mm-hmm, rate, it sort of implies that there's a lot of people who would want a revolution, or mm, the, I guess the other option would be revolution. Is there any possibility of that? Do you think there could be anything that could turn the regime over?
So this is how different North Korea is from the rest of the world. I was listening to people coming from Ukraine and talking about how war is the worst thing can ever happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. It's true. Right now, war is the worst thing can ever happen to somebody, right, as an individual citizen. For North Korean people, that is the best thing can ever happen to them.
War.
Because in North Korea, if you commit a suicide, your family get punished.
Yeah.
The collective guilt, right? Mm-hmm. That the official gets. In North Korea, you're not an individual. Uh-huh. We are all part of group as, yeah, a collective. So when the people in the past could not kill themselves because they were afraid, if I kill myself, I'm going to put a pain on entire my generation and next generation and previous generation, and even the in-laws get affected through marriage.
Yeah.
But now people get so desperate, they cannot even think of other people, they just kill themselves. And the one thing I was constantly hearing from North Korean people is like, I wish war happened today. That was every day we were hoping for. Because even war, dying, like by just bullets, was better than putting that pain on our family members if we kill ourselves.
And Kim Jong-un's calling it a sin against socialism. So yeah, as well as him being the god of socialism, I guess, is the scripture.
Yeah.
Are you taught Leninist, Marxist thought in schools? Mm. Is everyone educated in that philosophy?
Right.
In North Korea, in the schools, is that what everyone is taught?
So initially, they did teach the people Marxism, Leninism, yeah, you know, the communism. And then in the 1980s, they found their own ideology, something called the Zute, self-reliance ideology, where we only rely on ourselves. Because until Zute, the Marxism idea was the states take care of people, uh-huh, right? You surrender your property rights, your lot of, you know, the individual that deserve, you give it to the state. Uh-huh. And for return, the state gonna give you free housing, free food, the job that you get, free school, all of it. Uh-huh. But then the regime realized they cannot do that to give it to people because they ran out of money out of Soviet Union. Uh-huh. So they found this ideology where something called the self-reliance. You cannot trade, you cannot own a property, you don't have any right, but you need to take care of yourself and you need to take care of the state. And that's why they flipped the story afterwards.
Oh, I see.
And now this idea of self-reliance where people, the regime don't take care of you, but you are forced to work for the regime for free, forced labor.
I see.
And they just completely enslaved you.
Uh-huh. Mm. There's another thing I've learned about, mm-hmm, North Korea, and there's a writer, a British writer called Louise Perry, mm-hmm, who actually I've had the pleasure of interviewing as well, but she wrote recently that the existential threat to South Korea is more urgent than for most countries, and this is on the topic of birth rates.
Right.
Total fertility rate in South Korea is 0.78, mm-hmm, and its population is 51 million, mm-hmm, which will likely decline to just 15 million by 2100.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, North Korea's population of 26 million is expected to drop only slightly to 23 million. Mm-hmm. In other words, South Korea's much poorer, much more authoritarian neighbour, mm-hmm, is currently half its population size, but within the lifetimes of babies being born in Korea today,
yeah,
that balance will be upturned. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? Do you think, how will that demographic change, mm-hmm, affect the Korean peninsula?
So in a way, this fact shows a testament how North Korean women are so oppressed because we don't even know what condom is. Huh. We are so poor. Like, we literally, I've never seen a trash can in my life because we had nothing to throw away. We don't even know what shower is. I've never seen a world mattress in my life. We don't have, like, something called bed linen, you know. We are sleeping on the floor. We go to river to take a bath, and we don't take a bath in the wintertime. And North Korean regime, something called assigned marriages. So men goes to military, women have to go to military, and then when you're done with the military...
Assigned.
Of course. They say, this group marries that group, then they have to get married. It's not your by your choice. And when you get married, because we don't know what the contraception is, it's not your choice to have your reproductive rights for you.
Yeah.
They have to produce a child for the regime.
Oh, my
goodness. You don't have a child for your family, that you reproduce and get married for the state's sake. That's why people are, women are forced to give birth. Even though in North Korea, we don't have formula. So if the mother are malnourished and doesn't have the breast milk, children die in North Korea. So many children die. And if the mother dies from childbirth, the baby was left alone. We have seen so many men, like, knocking the door. My wife died. Can you give some of your breast milk to my child? But if the mother gives the breast milk to somebody else, their child gonna starve. So, like, the biggest regret to this day my mom has is the day she gave my birth to me, and somebody in the hospital, the woman did not have any breast milk because of malnutrition. So she gave her milk to that baby. And then when I was hungry, she didn't have any milk for me. And she was like, why? I cannot believe I've done that to you. Because the survivor is so hard. And this is why the North Korean women have children. Not because there is more opportunity and the society is better. For comparison, South Korea, women have so much rights. Even though their society might eventually collapse, they still have the right to choose not to give birth.
Sorry, I don't understand. The reason why North Korean women have babies, it's not that they're choosing to. It's quite the opposite. They don't have a choice.
They don't have a choice. The government assigns your marriage. You get married. You need to have a baby.
And is there literally no support for mothers? What's the healthcare system like in North Korea?
Theoretically, it's a free healthcare. But there is no healthcare because the doctors are starving. Their average salary per month is not even a dollar. They cannot even eat themselves. So literally, a nurse uses a one needle that is so thick and dull to every patient.
There's
no sanitation. They use a beer bottle as a drop. And they cut your bones without any anesthesia. And people don't die from cancer in North Korea because you don't last until that long. You just die from mere infection and fever.
Oh, my goodness.
So life expectancy is much lower than South Korea.
Wow. What is life expectancy?
It's really depending on the region, but like if my grandmother died before her 60, and people said, wow, she lived a really long time. And they were like, you don't need to grieve because she lived so long. And now I come here, people like in their 50s, they are like young. And my mother, who was 36, they called her like grandmother from there on. And here I meet so many women at 36 hours, not even married. In North Korea, their grandmothers, they start calling grandma.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's astonishing. How would you like to see things go in North Korea? Like, do you actually, you know, you're here in Oslo advocating for North Korea, but what do you actually, in realistic terms, think can change there?
So I have tried to work in the, for the last decade, you know, really solving the symptoms of the regime. We were like, mass defection, the people go to China, like I was being sold like modern day slavery as sex toys to these people. And I was really trying to rescue those people. But eventually the root of the problem is the regime. But that regime exists because of Chinese support. If we do not change CCP's policy towards North Korea, we are not going to help these people.
If we don't change China's policy to...
They literally sponsor North Korean dictatorship. They run the dictatorship.
Yeah, why do they want it? What's it in their benefit? Because China support North Korea. They without China, North Korea would crumble.
Cannot exist. Right.
So what's it in it from the point of view of the Chinese or the CCP? What do the CCP get from supporting North Korea?
So there are several things. Literally, Mao sent his own son to Korean War and he died. That's much how Mao was investing in Korea. He lost his own son there. The relationship that China describes with North Korea is like between the, your relationship with your lip and your teeth. If you don't have your lip, your teeth gonna have all the air comes in and it's, you cannot eat things. If you don't have teeth, of course, you cannot chew. So you cannot, like, you die. So you need each other to survive. The reason is that China has a lot of independence movements within China. There are 56 different ethnicities. We met the Uyghurs. Yes. We met the Tibetans. Yes. There are so many people who do not identify themselves as a Han Chinese.
Yes, but the vast majority are Han Chinese.
Right, but there are a lot of ethnicity that do not want to be part of China.
Yes.
So North Korea is a buffer zone. There is a South Korea down below, and there is Japan, and across the ocean, there is America. That wave of movement of democracy coming in at their door. But North Korea keeps that, buffer it. So nobody in China can see across the river at night what we do. Like, why they have freedom. Why those people have so much more prosperity than us. So North Korea keeps that for them. And then the second one is a leverage stick against America. Whenever North Korea tests missiles, where does America go to? They have to go to China to beg them to, like, North Korea to dial it down. So it's a leverage stick against America.
I see.
And also the third one is like really North Korea make them look so much better, the reputation wise.
Yeah.
That as long as North Korea exists next door.
Oh, so the Chinese people go, look, it could be worse.
Yeah, it could be so much worse. Publicity wise, so much better. And also international society, North Korea is so bad, we're not gonna much as focused on North Chinese human rights issues. Right.
When you describe the lips and the teeth, that sort of analogy, is that with reference to our communist brothers, or is it more ancient than that? Is it that they're the two communist states, or they are two communist states next to each other? Is that the depth of that relationship?
So that was what Mao described to his own party, why it's so important to defend North Korea. They sent so many Chinese soldiers to die in the Korean War, fighting against America and the UN, right? And international, like Western hemisphere that came in the, during the Korean War. That we need each other to survive. We cannot survive without each other. So at our cost, we need to defend North Korea.
I see.
And we need to keep it as it is.
Okay.
So that's the analogy he gave it to the Communist Party members and told them why they, we need to die for North Korea eventually. And he sent his own son to die for it.
Wow. What do you think the correct policy is from, say, America towards North Korea? Is there's the kind of Dennis Rodman approach where he goes over and he's friends for life with Kim Jong-un, or there's Trump, who made a point of being, was he the first president to go to step foot into North Korea? What would you like to see from the American regime in dealing with North Korea?
I think America needs to be very strong. They need to understand their standing in the world. That China needs America more than America needs China. America is a very unique country. They don't need other countries to survive. They have their own oil inside the country. They have such a big economy that they don't need other countries in a way, right? Even though so much happening in the world, America as it is, they can survive, right? They are on, unlike other countries. And China's economy is heavily relied on export. And America is a huge partner in that. And if America stood up saying, we are not going to do trading with you if you do not control North Korea. Like, North Korea is developing a weapon that can destroy America eventually. They have already weapon that can reach mainland of America already. And in a way, like, it's too big to fail. Like, eventually, North Korea's capability is so high. If we are already there, right, that North Korea's capability is so high that they can completely destroy Japan and South Korea, Seoul.
With their nuclear weapons.
Right, with their, even just with their nuclear weapons, they have so many arsenal that they're going to destroy South Korea, especially Seoul, that has like 15 million people living there. And I think because of America was so apologetic and would not stand their ground and do not call out China, and so many politicians... Because what is a government? What is a government? It's a collection of individuals who have so much their self-interest. And they have so many lobbyists in giving them, helping them to get elected. And those people give them money and resources. These politicians, they have so many people who make money with China. So these politicians, when they get elected, they go to Congress. they don't do the right thing. Mm. They do what's right for them. Mm. And I think this is the idea where, like, somehow we think governments are better than individuals. Mm. They're somehow immortal bodies. Like, they are just collection of selfish people. Mm-hmm. And did not make the right decisions till this point. Mm-hmm. And now North Korea is truly too big to fail. They have so much capability. We cannot just, like Iraq, just go there, remove the dictator. Because mm-hmm. really, we endanger like at least 50 million South Korean people, right, like an hour apart yeah. down there.
I sort of take that answer to mean that America's policy to North Korea really is America's policy to China yeah. primarily.
Exactly. So
are you concerned about China on the global scale?
Very much. Yeah. I mean, just imagine what we went through with the pandemic. Yeah. If they just came forth about clearly what was happening mm-hmm. and transparently, we could have saved so much people, world resources, and our time. Mm. And the damage they just caused. Like, we learned the threat of China through the pandemic. Mm. And if that is just the beginning. Mm-hmm. Literally, it's just the beginning. We have no idea what they're having, what's coming for us afterwards. And the fact that we don't hold China accountable, what was happening with the pandemic right now, mm. that's what's disturbing to me. Imagine this was the job of America. Mm. We caused this pandemic to the world. Mm. How they're gonna condemn us so much till our grave. Mm. And nobody condemns China because they are all making money out of this evil regime. So I think that's the thing, is we continue to see that in America and everywhere, just people try to make the money for themselves and don't do the right thing.
If I can just go back one step, just ask about North Korea, because you're on the board of the Human Rights Foundation, and in February this year, the Human Rights Foundation announced a new North Korea program where they were going to extract information to monitor what's going on within North Korea, as well as send in information to try and ideas about liberal democracy to try and maybe change people's opinion from within.
Yeah.
Do you think that these are going to be effective means of actually changing North Korea?
It is a very good alternative option. If the world leaders not gonna step up and asking China to stop sponsoring the North Korean regime, this is the best thing that civil society can do. Because what that extracts information means that North Korean regime conducts so many illegal businesses to make money. Mm. And with that money, keeps the concentration camps, and that money is especially spending on building more nuclear weapons. Mm. That is threatening the entire humanity. Mm. It's a threat to humanity, really, what North Korea is building. Mm. So they are going to look for the information that how North Korea makes that money, and we block them. In a North Korea is very scared, like evading sanctions, and that's why we need to be even more scared than them to find out why that money going into the dictator's hand and make it harder for him to get more resources to build more nukes. Mm. And that's going to be a battle, but it is a very important battle to have.
You talk about nukes, and do you really think that Kim Jong-un is foolish enough to actually start a nuclear war? And if he was, wouldn't Xi Jinping say, don't you dare start a war? Do you think he would be so reckless? Are you actually concerned that he would use those weapons?
So inside North Korea, when I was growing up, we were saying how brave our dear leader Kim Jong-il was. Mm. He literally said, there is no world without North Korea. There's no humanity without North Korea. Mm. If we really come, that means the regime, the Kim family. Yeah. Literally, if there is a moment comes that he feels like they cannot maintain their power, they're gonna blow it up. I don't think they are capable yet to blow up whole world. They will blow up Seoul for sure, and maybe some Japan, right?
So but they're backed into a corner. You think that they would?
They would, but until that point, I don't think they will, because they're not stupid, they're very logical. They need a nuke because they want to continue the power. They maintain the status quo. Mm-hmm. They're using it not to destroy somebody. They try to protect their own regime. So that's why they want to get a bigger nuke, because that means they have more protection. Mm. That's why they keep building it. They put every resources. So basically, testing one nuke, the equivalent of money that feeding entire nation for an entire year. Mm. Kim Jong-un so far conducted more than 50 nuclear tests.
Mm.
If he did like four less of them, nobody had to die entire time of his reign from starvation. But he would not do that. He put everything he has to testing more nukes and not feeding people.
We talked earlier about the dire states of living conditions and life for North Koreans, and actually, if the leaders are prepared to tolerate such horrible conditions for his people, if the supreme leader is happy to tolerate that, then actually it's not that much of a leap for him to sacrifice the whole of North Korea, I suppose. It actually reminds me of Fidel Castro's autobiography. It's actually written as an interview, but he publishes this letter exchange, and he says at one point, start the nuclear war, the Cuban people will be happy to sacrifice themselves for the communist revolution. And the Soviet Union's reaction was, whoa, Castro's crazy.
Yeah.
He told Kennedy, hey, okay, we need to sort this out. He's gone loopy. And fortunately, we had him to calm things down. So if Kim Jong-un is that crazy, might Xi, and I've kind of already made this point, get him to just calm down? Do you think he respects Xi Jinping enough that he would listen to him?
He has to, because China has all the keys. So basically how their attitude towards their own people. So in the 90s, when I was a toddler, just born, there was a mass starvation going around the country. Like millions were dying. And then the officials would literally go to Kim Jong-il, like, dear leader, people are dying from starvation. What should he do? And he said, he was laughing, let them die. It's easy to do socialism when there are less of them. It's easy to control people when there are less people. That's why this Marxist ideology hates people.
Yeah.
This anti-human sentiment. They think humans are poison. So hard to control. They don't want us, that many of us, to control. So that's why he was literally laughing. It's like, let them die. It's a good thing for us to control them. And basically their policy is there's 10% living in Pyongyang, the capital. The royal class, that regime wants those people only, right? So until the 90% of the population dies off, we are not going to do a thing about it. So that's their policy. Their tolerance stops when there's 90% dies off. They're going to only willing to fight for that 10% of the core group that supports the regime.
Yeah. Wow. And so you've now come to live in America, live in the West, and you have been writing in your most recent book, While Time Remains, it's critical of the West. And it reminds me a little bit of when Alexander Solzhenitsyn left the Soviet Union. He was expelled in 1974, eventually settling in America, in Connecticut. And he did a tour of universities and did these great speeches, which are collected in a book called A Warning to the West. Now, Solzhenitsyn could have been embraced as a hero, an American, sort of a Russian who turning against the Russian regime. And instead, he went to America and criticized America.
Right.
He criticized their shortcomings, where he felt they were failing their own people. And it's astonishing essays to read, speeches to read, but it reminds me a little bit of your time. You've come to America and now you're criticizing a turn to authoritarianism. What can you tell me about that authoritarianism that you see in the West?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because for me, socialism or Marxism is not a theory that I'm reading in a nice library with air conditioning on. It literally was my daily life. I knew how that was actually panned out in reality, not as just a nice theory in a textbook. And when I come to America, there are so many people who want that theory. They worship that theory. And they hate America. Anti-freedom, anti-America is so deep-rooted in American, like, leftist minds that they hate America to guts. Literally, in the university, professor says that the only solution for all these problems is dismantling American system, destroying America, destroying Western civilization as we know it. And the alternative they wanted is not even something different. What we have tried, the Marxism, collectivism, socialism, the same ideology that destroyed every single time it was tried. I think that's why it's so scary how humans are so dumb, keep repeating the same mistake.
Do you have any observations about why these ideas that you know to be ludicrous and actually are evil?
Yeah.
Like, communism is popular in some quarters and socialism is very popular in the West. Why is it that you think that they are popular? Do you think that comes from a sort of, I don't know, a nihilistic, about poor education or lack of experience? What, is it a different type of indoctrination? What have you perceived that is rooted in?
This is all of what you just said, like bad education, lack of experience of real world, and perspective, therefore. Mm-hmm. And of course, the brainwashing, the mass indoctrination begins in public school in America. Mm-hmm. But why also then the first place that began, right? I think it's got to be something innate human nature that wants to be taken care of with something greater than themselves, because humans are so vulnerable. Think about it, you, like us as an individual, we are so vulnerable. So many little things can easily kill us. Yeah. Even so many things can go wrong. And I think humans desire that protection.
Yeah.
And I think in the past, we had a religion where we somehow believed that there's a beautiful, amazing, loving God sitting in the heaven, making sure that we are safe, that we are provided. And that gave us comfort, even though that was a lot of times a tool to control people.
Yeah.
But it at least gave us comfort that things are going to be okay. Even if we die, there is going to be heaven waiting for us. In every religion, they all have this sentiment of going to a great place after death, giving you that comfort. Because otherwise, if you don't believe that life is meaningless, so sad. Like you work so hard and that's the end. You become a dust, you become nothing, right? And then as a society becomes more secular, we need to fill that void with something. And usually they want to fill that void with the government that feels strong. They have so much and they can take care of me. They can make sure that I'm going to be safe. I'm going to be taken care of in the hospital. I'm going to get a good education. And we're going to have a house to live in. And it's a dream. And it's, in a way, so sad. You know, humans are lonely. It's a real thing.
So it's part of this, you think, part of the death of God. You know, you talk about secularism.
It is.
Do you think America or the West, and certainly in my country, in Britain, Christianity is now a minority of the population. Is that the void that you notice is maybe the root of the issue?
Yeah, I think it's I became a mother in freedom. And until that point, I was atheist. I hated dogma to my guts. I hated, like, why nothing, if logically, if I cannot see it, I don't believe it. Because that's what North Korean regime was. It was a dogma that controlling us. And then I hated every religion. I was like, I'm an atheist. I don't believe any people. I thought the religious people are the most dangerous people in the world. And then when I became a mother, I would start praying.
Really?
Because I wanted my child to be safe. There's nothing I can do to protect him. And when I was pregnant, I was reading my pregnancy book. There are a million things can go wrong with his development. You're so helpless. And the only place that I could comfort was praying. I hope there is a God that's taking care of my child. I hope there is a God that's going to make sure that he's going to have a happy life. And that's the thing, like, that's when I realized, oh, that's why people are religious. Because it's a comfort that you get, right? And because life is so hard, genuinely hard. It's a dangerous place to be, even in Chicago. Especially in Chicago,
you know.
That time I lived in Chicago, now I'm in New York. And I think that's why I was realizing for the first time why people need a religion. It doesn't have to be a Christian God or a Buddhist God. It could be something that you find, you know, the comfort in. And it's so sad when they fill that gap, they fill that void with the government. Because governments are literally the collection of selfish people, liars, sitting in and saying that they are benevolent, which they are not.
Well, they're not just filling it with government. They're also, there's various new ideologies, trans ideology. A lot of wokeism seems to be a sort of surrogate religion to fill that God-faced vacuum. Has your prayer taken you to a specific religion or an organized religion?
I think no. I send my son to a even Buddhist temple. I love to go to a place where I can be humble and just pray. We baptize him in Catholic church. He goes to Catholic church. But it's not really like about what sector it is at the moment. I think this is a thing when I heard from Dr. Peterson. In 12 Rules for Life.
Yeah, okay.
You know, like, I live life as if God exists.
Yeah.
As if God is alive. Because if it is, it's a good thing probably. Mm. But even if it isn't, it's good to conduct your life as if God is there, who has a moral figure, who teaches you gotta love your neighbor and forgive other people.
Yeah.
And I think that's when I realized religion doesn't have to be that I see God every day.
Yeah.
That just live your life as God is real.
Uh-huh.
And it, life becomes so much, I think, in my case, it made my life way more peaceful. Uh-huh. You know, because then I don't have to be too much anxious.
Yeah.
And, well, that helped me at least. So we go to churches and...
How old is your child?
He's 5 and a half.
He's 5 and a half.
Yeah, he's starting pre-K this year.
and is this faith, is it helping you to build a moral compass for him? Are you referring to scripture or whether it's Buddhism or Christianity in order to help him form a moral structure?
Yeah, because it's in a way that what scares me about America is they say like, oh, America has too much freedom, I don't like it. I don't think it's the problem is having too much freedom. When you read going back to American founding fathers, when they built the country, they said, freedom without virtue, or in other words, discipline, is anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom needs virtue and discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And now what we see in America is anarchy, because they lost that discipline and virtue. Mm-hmm. Back then, the scripture provide that virtue to the people.
Yeah.
And that's how America was became, birthed through this humanity and became this beacon of hope.
Yeah.
Now in America, you're free, so you can shoot yourself up with the heroin.
Uh-huh.
Because you're free, you cut off your body part, that's fine.
Uh-huh.
Because you're free, you can do all of this. There's no right and wrong.
Yeah.
And there's no place to get that virtue and discipline come from.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's when I realized my child needs this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want him to become an anarchist and think that he can destroy his body and just conduct his life however he feels.
Uh-huh.
Not with a purpose, but just however you feel at the moment.
Yeah.
Because American culture is all about enjoying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
All of living in the moment.
Yeah.
Not about building your legacy and having a purposeful life. Just live in the moment, have fun.
Yeah. We've talked a little about some of the problems coming from the left in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you had insight into the failings of capitalism, whether you think that the right are making mistakes, the conservatives are in error. And that's, again, that's what Solzhenitsyn was really criticizing. He wasn't really criticizing the left in America, he was criticizing the capitalistic right.
I do think that joining of the corporation and government, especially like this time we saw, before Elon Musk took over, you know, Twitter, Facebook, they were all working with the American government.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge mistake in democracy.
Yeah.
You know, these corporations have so much power and government have so much power. When they unite, there's nothing can stop them.
Yeah.
And I do really think there is a danger to capitalism.
Yeah.
But this is the thing where, like, when I ask them, oh, what's the problem with capitalism? They usually give the example of inequality.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, the reason why capitalism is so evil because there's a homeless person and because there's a billionaire.
Uh-huh.
It's not fair.
Uh-huh.
But to me, that's not a problem why I have a problem with capitalism, because the sign of inequality is a sign of progress to North Korean person. Because in North Korea, do you know what happens if you want to become a homeless?
What happens?
They send you prison camp.
Uh-huh.
You have no right not to work.
Uh-huh.
The fact that there is a homeless to me is a sign of freedom. The individuals literally can choose not be responsible and just choose not doing nothing productive, right? Just want to be on the street laying down and smoking pot and shooting themselves with like drugs.
Uh-huh.
It's not the state fear them, in a way, the self. They fear themselves. And I don't blame it. A lot of times they have a mental illness and situation is not right.
Yeah.
But that is not because the capitalism is evil. Because there's so much tolerance that, unlike dictatorships, they don't put them in a prison camp and rape them and torture them and make them work in the forced labor camp.
So relatively, obviously, you could say it's better, but it's still not a good thing.
It's not a good thing, but I don't think that perfect society is possible.
Mm.
Because we're born with different capability. Like, I'm a mother.
Mm-hmm.
It was so random what kind of child I'm going to get. What kind of intellectual capability going to have, what kind of temper is going to have, what kind of health he's going to have, right? And as a society, we cannot take care of everybody.
Yeah.
It's not a perfect paradise.
Shouldn't we aspire to?
That is usually a path to hell to me, because we should not aspire to a perfect society. However, society that has a responsibility for yourself and your how make your bed, taking care of your health. And then if you took care of your body and your health and your mental care, then you can take care of your family members, then your community. It shouldn't be as a society a goal to make sure that everybody's not failing. I think that is a very compassionate ideology that is so trickable, because it sounds like so amazing. It's so sad seeing people on the street and suffering, especially in the cold and in the heat. But whenever we try to fix them all individually, I think that's when we're really getting into we need then big government, who can control every aspect of our lives. And that is, I think, where a dilemma begins. Because people really generally begin with a good intention. But then who do we want them to solve that problem? The government. Are they good at solving problems? Of course not. They create more problems than solving it.
But that doesn't mean one shouldn't try and solve those problems at all.
As individually, as a civil society, you can join a church, you can join a community service. If your passion is homeless problem, you can do it as an individual civil society. It shouldn't be government forcing to tax you and then try to create an industry where people making money because there's homeless people.
So through social enterprise rather than through government.
Yes. You would always support I really believe that we have a responsibility to take care of everybody else. It'd be an amazing world if we all took that responsibility. But it shouldn't be forced by government. They shouldn't be taxing all of us because they want to take care of... Because they always fail. We have tried. Do you know how much the San Francisco spend on each homeless person? They fail. They create more problems than actually not. And I think this is where conservatives and left in a conflict. Nobody deny that that's bad. Nobody deny that. But how to solve it, I think it comes down to difference. Right? Like, I would rather I choose to do it, and I would join the organization myself, like joining HRF or other organizations to do it, than hoping the government officers going to fix that problem for them.
You mentioned earlier that your concern with big government and big tech and the sort of revolving door between them, and actually that was Italian fascism. That is the definition of fascism, is government and big business in cahoots working.
China too.
In China, And so
the crony capitalism.
Crony capitalism, exactly. And how significant an issue do you think that is? Is that something that you're concerned about?
I'm very concerned about that. I really saw the power in these corporations and then government when they work together, because nothing can stop them. Google is more powerful than a lot of governments in the world already. And when they work with the US government, how do we stop them? And I think that's why the freedom of speech was a real under threat. Not because just of some one individual corporation thought you cannot say this word. This corporation is so powerful, beyond the nation, a lot of nations. And then they work with the government to decide what is true and what is not. And I think that is a danger of capitalism, but that is not a true really capitalism, it's a chronic capitalism. And I think we need to fight whenever we see that, when they gain too much power, there's no check and balances. And break them apart. And it's going to be harder and harder because they're going to have more power over time. And government's going to get more power. They grow so much already. And it's going to be harder to resist.
It's very striking to hear you as a North Korean concerned about free speech in the West. Have you experienced any impingement on your personal free speech? Because, you know, you're going around, you seem like someone whose speech is very much free. And and have you felt the impact of censorship at all in the West, not in, in North Korea?
So, well, where do we begin? I need to write another book on that. I am still shadow banned, even Elon Musk took over Twitter.
Really?
Yes.
And what for? Do you know?
No, I don't know. Even I just like take a picture of a strawberry and post it. It's like a sensitive content because it's coming from me.
Really?
Yes. And I am, of course, shadow banned. I don't have a, YouTube. I have a YouTube channel that has, like, now 1.1 million people following me. As soon as I created a China and support the Second Amendment, that video get blocked, demonetized, and get censored. So I don't have a freedom of speech on Google. And of course, on Instagram, they put me in a jail. Temporarily, I get shadow banned. And if I behave, I come out of the jail. Huh. You know, it's like punishment system.
And you think that's for criticizing China?
China, and of course, criticizing some transgender ideology where I criticize that, you know, people who are not men, like which is women. Yeah. Why would you not use the word women? Like people who have period. Women have period. And they say I'm a transphobic person because I believe that women have period. Because they think men can have too. So this kind of, you know, speech gets me in trouble. But not only through this tech companies. I was canceled by corporations like Samsung, electronic US company, not the South Korean one.
What did they do?
They scheduled my talk and they said my political opinions are not aligning with their values. So they canceled me.
And you think that was to do with trans opinions?
No, I think it was more China because they had a huge investment in China. And I was talking about the horrible corruption the Chinese government committing. So that was China because of that. Because China, I mean, they had a literally $2 billion investment in Shenzhen. And I was criticizing Chinese role in committing this crime against humanity.
Against the Uyghurs.
And North Koreans, and Tibetans, North and so many, even their own citizens, the Han Chinese get oppressed by their own regime, right? Chinese are not free. Even Han Chinese are not free. They are under the government's control. And then I was literally canceled by FBI. They invited me to speak. And then 2 days literally before my event, the head of diversity calls me. What to do with the head of diversity? They said, your political opinions do not align with our values, so we have to cancel your speech.
Your what opinions? Puerto Rico?
My political opinions.
Political, okay, really? Wow.
And then do you know what's funny about it? I became American last year, and in my American citizenship, the lady asked me, have you ever persecuted anybody for their political opinion? If I said yes, I could not have become American. So they don't even know what it means to be American because they never took an American citizenship test. In America, people cannot get punished for their political opinion. And these organizations like FBI, all the big tech companies and corporations punish people because of their political opinions.
Wow. That's astonishing. And
it
do you think we need to sort of change the FBI? I mean, that's a very deep-rooted, that's governmental. I mean, there are parallels with North Korea. It feels drastic to say it because of how awful North Korea is. But do you think things have any chance of getting better in America? Or is it, you live there, is it a country divided? Or do you think that its core values of free speech are not, can eventually unite everyone again? Are you hopeful for America?
So that's the thing. In a way, they did not earn their freedom. The people who were born in America, they were born to it because they were lucky. Nobody chose their birthplace, right? And I fought for my freedom. In a way, I was like, when they were censoring me, we need to strip their citizenship away and send them to North Korea. Right? Like, it just makes no sense. But that's a joke, really. Like, we cannot do that. I do think that's why we need the freedom of speech. We need to give people to have a voice so they can speak these opinions and tell people that what it means to be American, what it means to be in the Constitution, that what is protected under law. But these organizations, you know, any country is, they can fall into tyranny. America is not immune to it. Britain is not immune to it. Every country is possibly can become like North Korea. That the FBI persecuting somebody for their political opinion is a spectrum of North Korea, right? North Korea is a 10. They literally execute you, along with 3 generations of your family. America is somewhere in the middle, right? In the middle, for sure. Like, you can lose your job if you have a wrong political opinion in America. You lose your dignity. They character assassinate you. They literally, on Twitter, if you go, they say, I'm a liar, I'm a CIA spy.
You'd be called a CIA spy?
Yeah, of course. That's the first thing. It's like, I'm a, like, American imperialist.
Who's
I'm
calling
a race.
You that?
All the people, the Marxist people, all the
American
professors.
Marxists,
or like even in the European countries that who hates American imperialism. I don't think America has imperialism right now, but they say America is an imperialist country, and I support that. Therefore, I'm a CIA spy.
Yeah. On a personal level, when you have the world attacking you, how do you deal with that? How do you cope with that? That must be a tremendous burden.
It is. Some days are harder and some days is easier. It's like a back and forth, you know. It's a, but I did not know quite how many people were sympathetic to the idea of equity, which is a collectivism. Uh-huh. And when you criticize equity, you sound like such a horrible, compassionless, like heartless person.
Yeah.
Right? Like, their equity means let's give everybody equal opportunity and equality of outcomes. Yeah. And then, like, that's impossible. You cannot see the same result, yeah. right? Even people from North Korea, we all have different results in the society.
Yeah.
Not because American system is intolerant, because we all had a different capability
yeah.
to come here.
Yeah.
And we made a different result. Yeah. It's impossible to government to fix that.
Yeah.
And people really hate me for that, especially yeah. people on the left. And even some Democrats think that's evil, that I want to fight against equality of outcomes. Huh. And it's hard. It's like literally during the pandemic, I criticized the mask mandate for 2 years old. Uh-huh. You know, the ones that does not even know how to run quite well,
yeah.
they have to put this mask 8 hours a day. And the children who cannot speak for themselves. We don't even know what the long-term effect on them, uh-huh. not seeing human face and expression in that yeah. such an important crucial year.
Yeah.
And where all these rich people go to private island and have parties without masks,
yeah, yeah.
we cannot afford that. Children, like, I have to work, I need to put him in a daycare yeah. where he needs to wear the mask.
And what was then, your punishment for criticizing the mask?
And of course, I get like censored, all of that. But not only that, like literally, he had a playgroup and one of the moms saw it and then told their nanny, do not play with my son. Huh. Because of my political views.
Wow.
Do not play with my own. So it's like, this is North Korea. Like, you don't punish family members because of one person commits such a certain crime. It's like a, you know, the collective guilt.
Yeah.
Guilt by association.
Yeah.
Because my son is associated to me, he's responsible for my crime.
Yeah.
And that's what the communists do.
Do you think we're in a state of hysteria in the West? Have things calmed down since pandemic hysteria?
No, not in New York. Really? I live in New York. I mean, you remember recently the Jordan Neely yeah. who died in subway, who was convicted 40 times already? Mm-hmm. And I mean, they were just raiding the subways in Times Square, and it was bad.
Mm.
And I think, I don't know how people became this uncivil.
Uh-huh.
So uncivilized.
You know, you talk about equity, and it's really a war of words. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me immediately of North Korea, the People's Democratic Republic of North Korea.
Oh, yeah. China, too.
It's not the
People's Republic of China. Not,
It's the whole thing's, it's a manipulation. It is. A word game.
The disguise in a concept like safe space. Yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah. It's
definitely not safe. If you say one wrong thing, hurt somebody's feelings, you get persecuted. We are inclusive environment. Definitely not inclusive.
Yeah.
Complete opposite. Subversion of this meaning, subword. You know?
Exactly.
And I think that's what's scary, because in communist countries, a lot of times you don't know what that means anymore.
Mm.
Meaning got so inverted, and the governments really hide the meaning of the words.
Yeah.
And now in America, when you hear the safe space, like, of course you got to run, oh, dangerous space now.
Yeah.
It's inclusive space. Oh, definitely this not inclusive state at all.
Yeah. Wow.
And America becomes like that now.
On a more positive mm-hmm. note, before we started recording, we briefly talked about Jordan Peterson. You've mentioned him.
Yeah.
And he did the foreword for your recent book.
Yes.
And I understand he's been a great supporter of yours.
Mm-hmm.
How important is he to you as a figure and as a friend?
I think in a way, like, I lost my father so early, and I think I couldn't get those wisdom and father's guidance a lot. And I think when I read his book, I don't know why they say, like, he speaks to poor, uneducated white men. He spoke so much to me. That book became such a treasure of my life.
Yeah.
And it taught me how to be a parent, yeah. how to discipline my child. He talks about, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't teach them to be good until 4, nobody's going to like your children.
Yeah.
It's not a favor to them, because they're going to suffer.
Uh-huh.
Why you need to discipline your kids so people are going to like them.
Yeah.
And they get to get positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
America teaches a different idea. It's that you cannot hurt their feelings. Don't say no to your children.
Yeah.
They literally have this new pregnancy where if you want to change your infant diaper, you need to ask their consent.
Uh-huh.
Like, infant cannot talk, but like they still need to give you consent. Now that's why they say 2-year-old can decide their gender, right?
Yeah.
That's how they've gone so far.
Yeah.
And when you read the Dr. Pierce book, of course, it's like, that's not the case.
Yeah.
So it means so much to me, and it really, I cannot believe he supports my work.
Well, to continue the positive, and I ask a final question, which I hope will have a positive answer, is that you fled North Korea, but we've talked a little bit about the problems you're facing in America.
Yeah.
Will you be fleeing the US, or is there enough of freedom and enough concept there of a positive future that you think you want to spend your future there?
Because interestingly, that the world is so connected that, like, to me, in a way, America is the last hope. Not because they're like, Norway is amazing, Denmark is amazing. It's not in that way, because America was an experiment, right?
Yeah.
The nation was not united by the skin color or religion or the history, just the idea that individuals are created equal. We all deserve the rights to bear arms and freedom of speech. Believing in this one paper of document, the Constitution, if you believe in, you're American. Doesn't matter where you're born, where you're from, what you were doing in the past, if you believe in, you get a new start, the opportunity of this land. It was an experiment, and it succeeded it. Now it's questionable what they're going towards too.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I believe in American dream.
Uh-huh.
And I really believe that this idea where we were created equal and we have an opportunity, equality of opportunities, not the outcomes.
Yeah.
And then Americans can achieve amazing things. Uh-huh. Look what America has achieved. Land of immigration. The immigrants came from such a poor countries, fleeing the tyranny.
Yeah.
They came, I mean, they created airplanes, I mean, motion pictures, I mean, Tesla, literally now. Yeah. They're creating rockets.
I mean, they're taking us to Mars.
Yes, I mean, and the Soviets did too, but America created way more
things. They didn't get us to Mars.
Yes, yes. And I think that's why I believe in America, and I'm not going to leave this time, because when I was in North Korea, what saddened to me was, like, I did not know that I was oppressed. And if you don't know you're a slave, how do you fight to be free?
Yeah.
And at least in America, we know that what's going on.
Yeah.
We know something is wrong.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's why I see hope.
Wonderful.
Not because there's problems, because we know there is a problem that exists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On that note, Yeonmi Park, an absolute pleasure to speak to
you. Thank you.
Thank you so
such
much.
An honor.
Yeah,
thank
honor was
you.
Mine. Thank you. And I'm sure watchers and listeners will have found that fascinating.
Thank you so much.